Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. It's just a few hours since the class of 2001 has been graduated. And as part of that ceremony, two outstanding teachers were honored for their work in the classroom. Lisa Sullivan, Associate Professor of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the School of Public Health, received the Metcalf Award and the $5,000 that goes with it. From the College of Arts and Sciences, Associate Professor of Biology Fred Wasserman was honored with a Metcalf Cup and Prize and $10,000. They are with us tonight, as is the man who presided over commencement when Chancellor John Silber conferred the awards, Boston University President John Wessling. And welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
President Wessling, let's begin with you. I know the awards were endowed by the late Arthur G.B. Metcalf. What are they, and what was intended by them?
Arthur Metcalf was one of the great pillars of Boston University for five decades. He was an alumnus. He was a faculty member. Indeed, he began the course offerings that ultimately grew into our College of Education. He was a trustee and for 18 years chairman of the Board of Trustees, as well as being one of the great benefactors of the university financially. It was his thought that Boston University should have a means of putting not its own money, but as it turns out, his money, where our heart is, which is in teaching. And therefore, he very generously endowed the Metcalf Awards for Excellence in Teaching, which he hoped would have three major results. One, of course, would be to identify our very best teachers and give us an opportunity publicly to say how much we value what they do and how appreciative we are for all that they accomplish. The second thing that he hoped that it would do would be to provide a procedure, a regularized way of identifying really superb teaching. And the third thing that he hoped it would do would be to send a signal to other faculty members, to parents, to the general public, to higher education in general, that teaching is one of the critical tasks of a university, and that no university that fails to take it seriously can itself be a serious university.
Professor Wasserman, Professor Sullivan, you've just heard yourselves described, I hear, in essence. What was the process that you went through that led up to the Metcalf Awards?
Well, we were nominated by our chair, in my case, Persons, because I happen to sort of split my affiliations. And then I was lucky enough to make it to the next round, where we were asked to provide materials on what we do, showing what we do in the classroom, our syllabi and our teaching evaluations and whatever else that we felt was relevant to show what we did. And then we were visited in the classroom, which I must admit was a little bit nerve-wracking, but it was exciting. It was a very exciting process just to be part of it, and I'm so thankful to be here.
And I understand you had to write an essay as well as part of it.
There was a two-page essay that was asked for to state our teaching philosophy, and that's always very difficult. Well, it's very difficult to place on paper something that you've been working for all your life, so that is a difficult part of the evaluation, I believe.
So we're not talking about a popularity contest here.
Not at all. We are talking about a very searching process. It includes, as you've just heard, not only statements from the candidates themselves, but statements from current students, from alumni, from colleagues. The committee that evaluates the Metcalf nominees each year is a very high-powered committee comprised of former Metcalf Award winners, and some students, and a couple of administrators. And the paper that is generated is voluminous. The dossiers on Professor Sullivan and Professor Wasserman are inches thick, and they are discussed along with the other candidates in a very, very thoughtful committee review process, and ultimately the committee's recommendations come to me, and I have the pleasure and sometimes, though not this year, the difficulty of choosing among very well-qualified people.
So what, well, let me ask both of you, what kind of teachers are you?
All I can say, and I said this in my letter, I love to teach, and it's just, it's fun for me to be in the classroom with all of the students, and I happen to teach large classes, so unfortunately, I don't get to make as many personal connections as I might like, but I just love to be there. I love to work with them. I like to hear from them. And I like to think that there's sort of a mutual respect in the room.
Now, I read over your statement in preparation for this program, Professor Sullivan, and you talked about wanting each student to succeed and working with each student. How do you do that with such a large group?
You can tell when people are falling by the wayside. And it doesn't matter if there are five people in the room or 150. You can tell that they're not with you. And I try to get those people in, and I encourage them to come into the office, and we talk. And it's not always about statistics, but we talk about what's going on and what might we do to get them on track.
We'll get into that statistics, which sounds to me like a really fun subject.
I bet.
A little bit later. Professor Wasserman, you're a biologist. Your field is behavior in birds and applied to humans. How do you convey that enthusiasm that you obviously feel as an ornithologist to students who are coming fresh to the College of Arts and Sciences?
Well, I think it's very easy in the sense that I consider the teaching of science to be a pleasure. It's an easy task because it allows the students the opportunity to think. And if I can enhance their opportunity to do so, it makes my job so much easier. And the part that I think I'm able to do, maybe more so than most other fields, is to bring it out in the form of relevancy to their lives. And it's particularly easy with the courses that I do teach. For instance, in animal behavior, instead of just simply presenting material, categorizing terms and definitions, I'll much more prefer talking about the evolution of a particular subject that they see every day.
Give me an example.
Well, let's take, for instance, one of the first sections I do in animal behavior. It's on the topic of animal rights. Huh? And you pick up the Boston Globe, and there is Peter Singer on the cover. In fact, last week in Boston, he spoke. And he spoke at a conference that had Jane Goodall as well. So my students are presented with some of his ideas, and I had a student in class that took animal behavior with me, currently is taking ornithology, and he was so delighted that he had learned the material about, first of all, Peter Singer's work and the ethics of treating animals. And then all of a sudden, there he is in front of an auditorium where he's able to hear a lecture about that field. And he's beginning he's going to start a group on campus about preservation of primates. It's just absolutely simple and rewarding. And it's I thank Boston University always for the opportunity to do so and to be able to teach. But go ahead.
I was just going to say, Professor Sullivan, you sometimes come in with newspaper clippings.
Right.
To relate, as Professor Wasserman was saying, what the students are getting directly to what is going on in the larger world.
Right. I mean, that's the point you made about it being simple. It is. Because for me, for statistics, you can't pick up a newspaper or listen to a news report without hearing the results of some statistical analysis being presented. And so I do the very same thing. I will take articles out of the Globe and bring them into class, and we'll talk about them. And then they can go home and read them, hopefully, a little bit more critically than they might have in the first place.
And Lisa is correct in any one of us. It's an opportunity, though, to take that information, provide it to the students, and to ask them to begin to work with it and think about it.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. Our guests are Metcalf Cup and Prize winner Professor Fred Wasserman, Boston University President John Wessling, and the Metcalf Award winner Professor Lisa Sullivan. And we're talking about teaching and what goes into it and what comes out. Let me just go around the room, if I may. Fred Wasserman, what was it that moved you to become a teacher, to spend your time working with young minds and doing research in the field at a time when, as everybody says, you could have traded those skills in the commercial marketplace for considerably more? What was it that moved you?
I think what inspired me to go on and pursue the teaching was the opportunity one gets as a teaching fellow in front of a classroom. And the inspiration came with the responses of the students. I felt that it was very, very rewarding to see how they would respond to the way I would teach. And over the course of many years now, it's a process of evolution where the more I get back from the students, the more rewarding it becomes.
But aren't there times when you'd say, look, I'm just going to throw that whole thing over and I'm going to check on the white-throated sparrow from now until the end of time? That's really what I want to do.
That is a large portion of the teaching as well. My own research is something that I can bring into the classroom as a scientist. So it never was something that I looked at as a separate entity.
Was there somebody in your early life when you were a child that I see you nodding?
I think what it was an opportunity once again in college where there was a professor who, for the very first time, took me out working on Long Island Sound. Stony Brook is located in a very beautiful area of Long Island. And just becoming involved. It was also also a product of the times in the early 70s, late 60s. There was a change in a feeling about how we should be treating our environment. Now, that, of course, began before that, Rachel Carson in the early 60s. However, by the time I entered into school, it was much more acceptable than it may have been in the 50s and may it be today. So it's an interesting product of where we are.
Lisa Sullivan?
No. I really didn't grow up wanting to be a teacher. I mean, it wasn't my dream from day one by any means. I always loved school, and I liked my math teachers in school because I liked math. And there, looking back now that you're making me think about it, there were some that I really thought were great. And it was because I thought that they were so smart and they could tell us what was going on. And I guess they really were good teachers at that time. I just have had some opportunities. And like I say, I'm not the type of person who sort of plans everything out. Doors have opened for me. I've been very lucky and landed where I am, and I really do consider myself a very lucky person to be doing something I just love.
Mm-hmm.
And as Fred is saying, the feedback that you get from students, you can't describe it to someone else. You know, people don't understand unless you're in it, what you're doing for somebody. And it's not that I'm purposely going out of my way. It's what I want to do, and I'm helping people to be more confident, and, you know, so they tell me, and doing things, and that's great.
And President Wessling, growing up in Yakima, Washington, any inspirations that...
I think I'm like Lisa. I did not intend to be a teacher. Both my parents were school teachers, and I thought that I would strike out in different directions. I fully intended to be a lawyer, probably to go into politics, maybe some other professional fantasies, but teaching, no. It was a teacher who made me a teacher. I had a great, great teacher when I was a sophomore in college, Richard Hutton Jones, a remarkable intellect, a guy who deeply cared and deeply knew about his subject, and who took it seriously enough that it was important to him that his students learn to take it seriously.
And his subject was?
Medieval history. And so I became a medieval historian, not because I had some prior enthusiasm for medieval history, but because a great teacher showed me a kind of life, a kind of posture towards the world that seemed to me to be as important as anything that I had ever run into. And it was that, and I was lucky enough thereafter to have a succession of really remarkable teachers who cared about me, cared about my development, cared about the subjects that we were studying together. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's such a great thing that the Metcalf Prize exists at Boston University, because every time I get those nominations from the Metcalf Committee, I have the strong sense that I am able to, on behalf of generations of students, say thanks to people who are making a really major impact in the lives of young people.
All right, so what do we have? In this room we have biostatistics, and we haven't really touched on that, Lisa. I have not quoted Mark Twain as saying, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. We're going to get into that a little bit. Oh, that's right. Oh, I'm sorry. But we have an ornithologist, biologist, a biostatistician, and a medieval historian, all of whom clearly have enjoyed time in the classroom. What would you think, given the disparity in your subjects, I mean, three more diverse I don't think we could find, you have in common?
Well, just in terms of teaching, what Fred said earlier really resonated with me is making the material relevant. We understand how to apply our own disciplines, hopefully, but it's conveying that to someone to make them interested and understand what it is and what the importance is. And it seems to me we all have a sense of what it is we're doing, that it's important, and we are conveying it.
So there's a communication function involved in there.
Yeah.
It's almost as if we're talking about two separate talents, a talent for the particular subject and then a talent for communicating it.
But, you know, I think the two are deeply and mysteriously intertwined. There are people who are wonderful teachers who would not strike anybody as eloquent or poetic. They are simply so powerfully possessed by their subject that their passion, their fascination, their sense of the ultimate seriousness of this stuff shines through, even when the presentation is less than polished. And there are elegant, eloquent, snazzy presenters who are shallow and empty, and students are not stupid. They sense whether they are important to the teacher or whether they are merely a kind of convenient sounding board against which somebody is performing. And no matter how polished the presentation, unless that inner conviction is there, real teaching doesn't take place.
Sounds like passion is central to successful teaching.
I think that is the common thread. It is the love of what we do and the desire to convey that love to the students.
Well, that's what we're talking about tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. We're talking about teachers with the president of Boston University, John Westling, and the two teachers who were honored earlier today with the Metcalf Award, Professor Lisa Sullivan, and with the Metcalf Cup and Prize, Professor Fred Wasserman. So what's the actual nuts and bolts of teaching? What are we talking about? What do you do? Do we mean textbooks, lesson plans, tests, all of it, new insights into old material, old insights into new material? You're the statistician. How does that add up? What percentage?
Well, I teach the intro classes.
Okay.
Here on the main campus to the undergraduates and over at the School of Public Health. It's the first class in biostatistics. And the material is not brand new. The techniques have been around. But the way I try to present things is with new and hopefully relevant examples. things that are coming out of the newspaper or the journals that these students are reading, so that they can see that what we're talking about in class really is something that they need to understand. I must admit, when I was an undergraduate, I'd sit in class and I'd study and hopefully learn the material, but I never made the connection that this is going to help me somewhere else. I really didn't feel that I was learning things that I could then really directly apply, and I feel that way about statistics. And that's why I bring the examples, and I keep sort of pushing it on them that this is the proof.
Okay, give me an example that you may have used recently that riveted some people that are saying statistics.
There was an article that came out in the Globe, maybe it's a month ago now, talking about a study that was done among high school students in Boston and across the country, looking at students' thoughts of suicide.
I remember that one.
Yeah, and I brought that to class. It was in the Globe. And they were estimating something like 10 to 15% of high school kids have contemplated suicide. And I was just floored by that number. And we talked about it in class, the number, and what else is going on? How do we understand that number? And what does it mean? Was this going on for people that were sitting in the room? And it turned into a big discussion. And that's the kind of thing that
you
I like
mean
to
they,
do.
They came out, they talked about their own personal experiences,
sure.
what they
yeah.
had said,
yeah.
what they told other people, how yeah. they got past it, all
yeah.
of that.
And also, how do you go about doing a study like that? The number, if I recall it correctly, was 10 to 15%, something like that. And I thought that was extremely high. And then we talked, well, do we think that's really the right number? Would that be more likely to be an underestimate or an overestimate? How do you get that kind of information? Do you think people honestly answer those kinds of questions? All of that.
Fred, I see you nodding.
No, I agree with the way of trying to bring out the relevancy. I was thinking of an example, maybe one not as emotionally draining as the suicide. However, every presidential election, one part of my course in animal behavior is communication. And there are certain theories about what communication is and how animals, how you measure communicatory responses. And we deal with it in terms of the experimentation. But then with the presidential election, it's an ideal opportunity to show 5 minutes of the Nixon-Kennedy debate on the videotape, and then 5 minutes of Reagan and Carter in 1980, and then as an assignment to the students to watch the first debate and do it with the sound off and count up the nonverbal signals mm-hmm. That are given. Bill Clinton had a wonderful aggressive thumb, and the responses of person who is up there, who is he watching? You know this in your field.
Yes, I'm not.
Where are the eyes fake focusing?
Right.
Is it on the TV or the person asking the question? And the students come back the next day, and we come up and we do a little statistics. We try to see how it panned out during the debate. But it's a fun process, and it isn't just simply saying communication is a response to a signal from a receiver, and it works.
Both of you are now dealing with present information in which you're linking it to daily events.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that medieval history has probably remained pretty much the same. Or has it? Am I wrong there?
You're wrong.
Okay.
All fields change and evolve. There have been actually some fairly substantial changes in the last generation in the way people think about the Middle Ages. But I think that in terms of teaching the Middle Ages or any subject in the humanities, the issue is less the most recent article that has appeared in the scholarly journal. The way that you connect to students is through the really deep questions that the humanities raise. When I teach, as I do when I teach freshmen, Homer, and we read the Iliad, me for the nth time, them probably for the first, I am still struck by issues of leadership, Odysseus is captain of a ship. He manages to lose essentially his entire crew. What do we make of leadership like that? Relationships are important to everybody, but they're probably really most important to late adolescents. And we have Penelope and her fidelity. And what sort of world is it in which such fidelity is possible? And what's the stance that that students ought to be taking in their own relationships towards questions of trust and fidelity and loyalty? Mm-hmm. These are perennial questions. They are questions that every human being has got to face, and they are particularly powerful, particularly poignant, I think, in the years in which people are in college, in their late adolescent and early adult years. So the relevance of medieval history, of questions of betrayal and loyalty, of questions of organization and leadership, of cowardice and bravery, whether one's teaching medieval history or modern history or the classics, these are questions that come up, and they are deeply fascinating to young people. And often the problem, which I expect both Lisa and Fred will have had in their own work, different as it may have been from the teaching that I do, is to get people to move on.
John, when you were inaugurated, you made a very strong point of balancing teaching and research and saying that you were going to carry on the tradition that you were handed now as eighth president in making sure that the commitment to the undergraduates to see the people who did the research in the classroom was continued. I get a sense from both Metcalf winners that this is a part of an overall program.
We try. Our real reason for existence is teaching, the formation of the next generation of young men and women for leadership in their professions, in business, but way beyond that. They're going to be citizens, they're going to be parents, and as a university, we have responsibilities to them in those capacities as well. And I think what Lisa Sullivan and Fred Wasserman represent is the refutation that academic life is merely a kind of inward-looking, narcissistic self-indulgence for people who have interest in abstruse and uninteresting and useless subjects. You know, I think when I think back on my own education, and from what Fred and Lisa have already said, I think it's clear that when they think back on theirs, and I would expect that when your listeners think back on theirs, what they remember most is not the information, not the techniques or the skills, important as those are. What they remember is a set of caring adults who took them and their interests seriously, and who also were clearly deeply committed to the life of the mind as exemplified in a particular discipline of the mind, in biology or statistics or history or biochemistry or philosophy or whatever it happened to be. And the real magic of education is that deep human desire to emulate people whom you respect and admire. And what Professor Wasserman and Professor Sullivan represent for me and for Boston University is really what we are about, what we are when we are at our best.
What can we, the public, do to improve teaching and studying on the part of our students? I think it was the South Dakota State University system has announced that every incoming freshman now is going to get a Palm
Pilot. Palm Pilot.
Palm Pilot, all right. Is that what we need, more computers or similar aids? Or
Absolutely not. I think that's a gimmick.
Yeah.
And the best thing that a parent could do for his or her kids, or a student who may be thinking about now going on to college, who is listening to this, can do, is to seek out the most demanding work that you can find in your high school curriculum, the toughest, most demanding teachers. Do that work. If there is an opportunity, as there is in most places in eastern Massachusetts, maybe to take a course at a local college or a local junior college to get your feet wet with a more rigorous and more demanding program, and to not decide too early that you already know exactly what your life is going to be, and to rule out by not taking chemistry or not taking Latin or not taking whatever it may be, because you know that you aren't interested in that and you know that you're not going to need that in your life. The fact is, life is a constant surprise, and 16, 17, 18, even 19 and 20, maybe 20, 21, 22, is too early to be making the kind of decisions that entail closing and locking a door that might otherwise be open.
Our guests are Professor Lisa Sullivan, Professor of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, Professor Fred Wasserman, biologist, ornithologist in the College of Arts and Sciences, and Boston University President John Wessling. And this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Let's talk about the students. Let's talk about the people who are the receptors of all of this. Start with you, Professor Wasserman. What changes have you noticed in the students since you first began teaching? And have you changed the way that you tried to reach them to reflect some new realities in society?
I believe that the first 2 years of college, the ages of 18 and 19, is a very unique time in the lives of our students. And it has been for as long as I've been teaching. And it is so often the case that this is a time when they begin to know a little bit more about themselves, about who they are because of the responses of others. They're away from home for the first time. And in that sense, we are not, I personally do not feel as if we're looking at a difference. That has been the way it is. And these students, it is remarkable to me. I do a good deal of advising as well, and I see them as freshmen. And there are those few opportunities that I see a student going from the freshman year and graduating, and it's a senior. And I'll sit up as I watch as they come by in the biology graduation, and I think back. That's something that's a remarkable experience of how much they have grown. And if you're thinking about the process of teaching, we have become more technological. There's nothing like what we can do today that existed back then. But there is a consistency with the students that I feel has not changed.
Lisa Sullivan, what is that consistency? I see you nodding.
Well, I was nodding to the technology part of it. Students are much more technologically advanced than I am. I can say that in some areas.
There's an admission.
You know, I mean, they're very comfortable with the computer, and that's a part of the coursework that I do. So I've certainly had to modify that because I don't have to take them from step one. They're already on step 10 as far as that goes. Also, I think that advanced degrees are much more important now than they were maybe years ago. There are many more students that continue on. So I do a fair amount of advising in terms of opportunities for graduate study and what careers are open to students, where many would have before graduated with their bachelor's and that would be it and see what you can do. Now many want to continue right into graduate school. So these kids come in as freshmen and they know exactly what they want to do. And as I told you, I can't relate to that, but that they've got a plan. And so there are things that they are setting themselves up for right from the word go. And so we have to help work with them and make information available to them to help them get where they want.
What makes a good student? We've talked about what makes a good teacher. What makes a good student? Somebody that you look at and you say, you know, that's a good student. What are we talking about?
Drive.
I think that there is a clear feeling that when a student is going further than simply what you are presenting, and they have an inner drive, as Lisa says, to learn more about what we've talked about, to pursue it, to come into you and say, please, help me understand this, and where can I go to learn more about it? That makes a good student.
Well, you said drive because your background includes college-level basketball. I mean, that's why the first word you said was drive, Lisa.
Yeah.
But yes, drive, all right.
And ones who are willing to or confident enough to come and talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad that so many more are not, because they don't have all the answers, and that's fine. They shouldn't. That's why they're here, I think. And it's not that any of us by ourselves have all the answers, but I encourage them, talk to me. I'll tell you what I know, but talk to somebody else and talk to somebody else. And there are plenty of places to go around this university that people can go, and I encourage them to do that.
So the students who reach out then as well,
yeah.
Not only are interested.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big university, let's face it, but they have so many opportunities here, but they have to take it upon themselves mm-hmm. to some extent to get out there.
That leads to a subject, though, that I think is worth pursuing a little bit further. There's a marvelous Jewish saying that an education is not a shovel to dig with, and yet this is a very competitive world, and some of these youngsters do come in saying, this is what I'm going to do, and this is why I'm going to do it. How, as teachers and as people who have the overall responsibility for the university, can you say to a youngster, you know, you're going to furnish your mind for the rest of your life now, the things that you do here. Let's not think too much about how I can trade it across the counter at the general store, at this point anyway.
Well, let me start by answering that by pointing to Professors Wasserman and Sullivan. I've been reading their student evaluations because, of course, that's what you have to do when you look at a Metcalf Prize winner nominee. And one of the common themes in the letters that I've received and in the evaluations that I've looked at for both of them is, you know, I was not looking forward to fill in the blank, biology, biostatistics. It was just a hurdle I had to jump. And you know what? Professor Wasserman, Professor Sullivan taught me that this is fascinating and amazing stuff. And now I'm fill in the blank, majoring in, going to graduate school, or working in this field that, had it not been for them, I might have just walked away from.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. We're talking about teaching on this commencement night with the winners of the Metcalf Award, Professor Lisa Sullivan, the Metcalf Cup and Prize, Professor Fred Wasserman, and the president of Boston University, John Westling. I'm Ted O'Brien. Let's talk about what education is. Do you think it's essentially solitary, one student going over notes and attempting to psych out what the professor's going to ask? Is it a formula, as in statistics, or a natural process, like biology? Or is it a communal experience, working together with peers, or all of the above? Lisa?
I'd say all of the above. In my classes, there are a lot of formulas, but I let the students use notes for the exams because I don't think they need to memorize the formulas. That's not what they want, what I want them to understand. I don't think that's what's important, memorizing formulas. So hopefully they learn to think and evaluate problems and learn how to solve them. I encourage students to work together with other students, form study groups. If they can't form them themselves, I'll form them for them and get them to talk with each other, because I think the way one person is hearing something and they spit it out to their peers, they might help one another to understand what's going on, or to understand the way to solve problems better. So all of those things.
I think that the notion of a solitary type of learning is one that's not going to work well, maybe today, maybe at any point. Unfortunately, in a very large lecture, sometimes you feel as if it is a solitary type of an experience. However, even there, and I'm sure Lisa does this as well, we have a topic in our field which requires a little bit of problem solving. And I get an enormous amount of pleasure out of saying, here's your problem. Explain it to your next door neighbor. Spend a few minutes having them do that. And it's a pleasure because all of a sudden the room erupts with noise. They're talking to one another. And the more you can do that, the easier it is on you as a teacher because you're not merely disseminating information. So you work at that, and it's not that easy.
Can a university structure that kind of a communal setting and encourage it in some way, John? How does Boston University seek to encourage that?
Yeah, I think it can be encouraged. Of course, education is a personal accomplishment. It's an individual accomplishment. You can't be educated for somebody else. On the other hand, it is, I won't say impossible, but it's very, very bloody difficult to educate oneself. It is very much a community activity. And it is particularly an activity that exists in the apprenticeship model. It works best when there are older, more experienced, intelligent, caring, thoughtful people around to help guide you and your cohort through to be guides along the path. And how do you create an environment in which that is not merely possible, but encouraged and where it's enthusiastically embraced? There are a lot of ways. But perhaps the most important is to try to get the values of the institution aligned with the priorities. And that is one of the reasons that the Metcalf Prize and the Metcalf Awards are so important, because it gives us a public chance. And I underline public here because teaching, though it is a communal activity, is a kind of semi-private activity, too. It takes place in the classroom. Typically, the teacher, at least, is by himself or by herself. There aren't colleagues around. It's not something that's broadcast. It is a chance for us to say publicly just how important and how valuable the kind of work that Professors Wasserman and Sullivan do.
How do you define success? At the end of a class, at the end of a week, at the end of a semester, Lisa?
When somebody can tell you they got it. And that doesn't mean they got an A. They just get what you're talking about. And they see the relevance in their own field. Statistics is a field where you work with any number of different disciplines, and that's what I happen to like about it so much.
Such as?
Medicine, law, political science, everything involves statistics. And like I said before, I come to the table as a statistician, and I bring one thing. But everyone else around the table is bringing something else, and that's what's fun about it, that you get to learn what other people are doing. So many of the students I deal with have other majors, and they're taking statistics as they start out as for a requirement. But then they realize, well, maybe this will help me a little bit in what it is that I want to do. So when they, or if they get that feeling that this really works for me and I get what you're saying, that's a success to me.
Fred?
I was thinking, I teach one course, too, in the spring, vertebrate zoology. 6 hours of laboratory, 3 hours of lecture. The only reason these students come to this class is because they enjoy the material. And success is student Danny, who was sitting in the back of the room through all but the last 2 weeks of lecture. And then the last 2 weeks of lecture, he moved his seat from the back of the room to the front seat, front and center, and asked questions that he wouldn't have done before. And that was this semester's success for me. And that's, I think, how I measure it.
And your timeline, of course, has to be somewhat longer, Professor. I mean, President Wessling. How do you measure success at the end of a semester, at the end of a year, at the end of now 5 years as president?
I think measuring success in a university is a complicated matter. In part because education is an individual accomplishment, and the most important measures of success for me are the stories that I hear or the students that I encounter personally who testify to what a difference the education that they've had at Boston University is making to them and will make to them. There are lots of other measures. Of course, I'm very proud at the way in which our faculty increasingly is winning support from the federal research agencies for the creativity and cleverness of their research proposals. I'm delighted that alumni and friends are providing more donations to the university. I'm particularly delighted when I look at the numbers of extraordinarily well-qualified young people who want to come to Boston University. But ultimately, the success of an institution comes from whether or not we are answering for our students the three fundamental questions that every human being puzzles over and wants answers to. And those questions are, what can I know, what must I do, and what may I hope? The questions that Immanuel Kant addressed more than 200 years ago. And whether we are answering those questions finally, I think, entails a certain exercise of hope that enough young people are getting close enough to enough faculty members like Fred and Lisa. And I'm confident that that's happening. Not as much as I would like to have it happen. We have a long way still to go. Every college and university does to achieve all that we are capable of achieving. But we're making great progress, thanks mostly to the intelligence and commitment and caring of people like Fred Wasserman and Lisa Sullivan.
How do you balance your teaching with your research? Obviously, you're both enthusiastic teachers, which is what led to your honors earlier today at commencement. But how do you balance that with your research in a way that satisfies you that you're also growing in that direction?
You have to do your research because that's what makes you a better teacher. At least that's what it seems to me. I bring examples from my work into class, and I need those examples and those interactions in my research work so that I can then tell students this is what's going on and this is what I'm learning in this other area applying this particular information. And I think they find it interesting. A lot of them come to me and say, can I be a research assistant on such and such a project? And how can I get into that kind of research work?
And you, Fred, you've got to get up, what, 5 o'clock in the morning to catch those white-throated sparrows out there.
Fortunately, it starts May 1st and ends July 15th.
Well, it's only the mating season that you're interested in? Is this what you're telling me?
Well, the birds are away for this, winter. But
sure.
In terms of the research, we have in our department a remarkably wonderful faculty with not only are they very good in the classroom, but I think one of the hallmarks of the department is the ability to incorporate students into the laboratory setting. So I think of the 150 some odd students that graduate every year, I'd say maybe 40% or so have assisted. Now, that's I think a relatively high percentage of students. It requires, as Lisa says, knocking on the door. But those doors open once that is heard.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so the research is really a very large part of the teaching process.
Mm-hmm. I think we're approaching the end of this, but I do have one final question to go around. We're at the beginning of a new century. In the United States right now, there are over 70,000 people over 100 years old, and the figure's increasing rapidly. And more particularly, there are more 60-year-olds than at any time in history. Yet university education, the undergraduate, certainly is geared toward 20-year-olds. Can that stay the same? And you have 30 seconds each to answer that.
Well, I think we have, as you must know, the Evergreen Program. And I get a delight out of the opportunity I have to bring some people who wish to come back to school. And that's very easy. And I think the education for our growing population, as it gets older, will be part of their lives much more so than it has been in the past.
I think it would be fantastic to have people come back and join our classes, but I think, you know, we're set up to do something here, and hopefully we're doing a good job, and we give people the framework that they can lead long, healthy, productive lives with what they learn here, on and on.
We are open 365 days a year. We are open to anyone who is qualified and who is serious about learning. And whether you are 18 or 80, if you have the passion and the energy and the intelligence and the imagination to benefit from outstanding teacher scholars like Fred Wasserman and Lisa Sullivan, we will be delighted to make them available to you.
Thank you. Boston University President John Wesley. Been listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight, The Art of Teaching, with the winners of the 2001 Metcalf Awards, Professors Fred Wasserman and Lisa Sullivan, and also the president of Boston University, John Westling. Join us again next week. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. You can access the program on WBUR.org or WRNI.org.